to go until the final election of a stunning midterm year.
I'm not that politician. Y'all don't look like one, don't dress like one, don't talk like one, do I?
This is not about right and left. This is about the difference between right and wrong.
Who has the momentum in Georgia, and what impact will it have in Washington? Plus, spewing hate, Donald Trump refuses to denounce anti-Semites like Kanye West.
There is no room in the Republican Party for anti-Semitism or white supremacy.
But is it enough to turn GOP voters against him? And President Biden repays a favor.
Thank you, thank you, thank you, South Carolina!
Democrats in the Palmetto State saved his 2020 candidacy. Now he wants them, not Iowa, to kick off his party's primaries. Inside Politics, the biggest stories, sourced by the best reporters, now.
Hello and welcome to Inside Politics Sunday. I'm Abby Phillip. Overtime is nearly over in Georgia's high stakes and high drama Senate race, with more than 1.8 million early voters already casting their ballots, and all eyes are on this Tuesday. Democratic Senator Raphael Warnock and Republican Herschel Walker spent the campaign's final days urging voters to head to the polls and making their closing arguments.
Now, I'm not mad that he doesn't know what he's talking about. I'm mad that he doesn't know what he's talking about, and he thinks he ought to be a United States Senator.
He's voted Joe Biden 96% of the time, which he didn't know he was voting with him or he loved that man. I don't know what he's doing, but it don't matter because he's doing the wrong thing for the Georgia people, because the Georgia people are sick and tired of what they're doing to them.
Now, the latest CNN poll shows Senator Warnock holding a narrow lead heading into this final stretch. And on the ground, there have been long lines at the polls, and momentum seems to be at the moment with the Democrats, who are outspending Republicans by 2-1 on the airwaves. CNN's Eva McCann has been spending many months in the peach state of Georgia covering this race, and she joins us now from Atlanta. So, Eva, it has been a very busy weekend in this very critical race for Senator Warnock, but lots of folks asking this morning, where is Herschel Walker?
That's right. Good morning to you, Abby. Just 2 days left until the votes are counted. And you are correct. Senator Warnock, Herschel Walker, could not be ending their campaigns more differently. Senator Warnock holding three public campaign events yesterday, Herschel Walker holding none. He did show up at a tailgate party to greet supporters and fans, but he didn't give remarks or take questions from the media. Senator Warnock began the day with union workers who then went out to go door knock for him and then ended with a big AAPI event. And I think that is noteworthy because the Asian American community is often described as an overlooked part of the electorate. And, you know, in this state, you can't overlook any group or anywhere, right? These candidates have to campaign in big cities and small towns with every demographic. Herschel Walker, for his part, has long argued that Senator Warnock is too closely aligned with President Biden, but that's not an argument we heard from him yesterday. His campaign in recent days has also knocked Senator Warnock for missing some key votes in Washington the last few days, because Warnock, of course, has been on the trail here in Georgia and not in D.C.
Yeah, especially in a runoff, every single vote has to be found and brought out to the polls. So what are you hearing, Eva, from voters on the ground there?
So if you go to these long lines during the early vote period here in Atlanta and you speak to Democratic voters, they'll tell you, listen, it shouldn't have even come down to this runoff. They describe Herschel Walker as an embarrassment. Meanwhile, you go to Herschel Walker rallies and you speak to his Republican supporters, and they say they think that he has been underestimated, and also that the ground game that Republicans have built in this state is being underestimated as well. Abby?
Eva McCann, thank you so much for all your great work on the ground there. Let's discuss all of this and more with CNN's Jeff Zeleny, Heidi Prisbella of Politico, Julie Davis of The New York Times, and The Atlantic's Adam Harris. So in this race now, it's boiled down to kind of the basics, really, which is, are voters going to default to the candidate who is in the opposition party, not in the leadership of the Senate, running on this issue of the economy, or are they going to focus on this? This is a CNN poll recently that asks voters, which candidate do you think is well qualified, Warnock with a 25-point advantage over Herschel Walker, has good judgment. 17-point advantage would effectively represent Georgia, a 9-point advantage, and has the right priorities, a 6-point advantage. I mean, that's really what it, what on the Walker, the Warnock side, it boils down to.
For sure. And despite all that, the race is still very close because it is Georgia and it is a key battleground state. And look, even though the Senate control is not necessarily hanging on Georgia, it matters tremendously for Senate committees and the makeup of the Senate for subpoena power, et cetera. But the real question is those ticket splitters back in November, a month ago, who voted for Brian Kemp, the Republican governor, and then Senator Warnock, the Democratic senator, are they going to basically leave their votes the same, or will some of them sort of change because of that check on the Biden administration? So the Democrats are in pretty confident, but not overly confident, because the voting period was shorter. The early voting period was shorter. So going in, there are some unknowns, but there's no doubt that some Republicans are not thrilled with how Herschel Walker's been campaigning in the final days. As Eva was saying, he's been pretty absent.
Yeah, the entire reason, to Jeff's point, that we're in this situation of a runoff is because 200,000 voters voted for Kemp and not for Warnock. So the question is not only are those folks going to come back out for the guy who they dissed on the ballot the first time, but are the folks who actually just marked a straight Republican ticket even going to come back out when so much there is not at stake here for the Republicans, meaning the Senate majority? And if you look at what's been invested or not invested over the past few weeks, outspent 2-1, where are all the surrogates who were here for the other Republican candidates? And I think that there's just a lot less motivation to help who is considered a flawed candidate when you don't have the Senate majority at stake.
Yeah, the absence of surrogates on the Republican side is very notable. They've been trying to keep former President Trump out of the state as much as possible. But on the Democratic side, former President Obama was in Georgia and making an argument to voters that Herschel Walker just doesn't deserve to be in the Senate. Listen.
Since the last time I was here, Mr. Walker has been talking about issues that are of great importance to the people of Georgia. Like whether it's better to be a vampire or a werewolf. This is a debate that I must confess I once had myself. When I was 7. Then I grew up. In case you're wondering, by the way, Mr. Walker decided he wanted to be a werewolf.
Yeah, Adam, I mean, it's funny. It's funny for sure. But I wonder, though, is that argument just for the Raphael Warnock voters who really can't stand what Herschel Walker represents? Or is it also trying to appeal to even some Republican voters who held their nose and might have voted for him the first time, but maybe can't make themselves do it a second time?
Yeah, you know, down the stretch, the Warnock campaign has really been trying to make this about, you know, character and competence, quote unquote, right? They continuously say this is about character and competence. Well, our candidate has that, and the Walker campaign does not. And I mean, if you look at the energy that voters have shown in this early voting period, you've seen something like 1.9 million voters have already gone out to the polls. 370 some odd million voters, 370,000 voters on the last day of early voting. So you've seen, you know, some of the rhetoric around, you know, our candidate, Raphael Warnock, is the candidate of character and competence, being kind of effective. And, of course, there's still a lot of votes left to be counted, something to the tune of 4.5 million votes in the last runoff election. But I think that they should feel they're likely feeling very comfortable going into Tuesday.
I mean, I think what we are hearing former President Obama try to replicate is the dynamic that drove a lot of the midterm outcomes prior to this, right, a month ago. This was sort of, and you heard Mitch McConnell actually articulate it not long after the balloting, saying that, like, the candidates that Republicans put forth in some cases frightened voters, turned off voters. And so I think Democrats are really trying to sort of exacerbate that dynamic and bring it back and, you know, make sure that, you know, given how close the outcome was on Election Day in Georgia, some of those Republican voters or leaning voters that are in the middle either just decide not to show up or just sort of look at what they're presented with and say, you know what, no thanks. Yeah, and, you know, just and either vote for Warnock or just don't vote at all.
Don't vote at all, yeah. I mean, and this early vote period is really critical for the Democrats. They have to really maximize whatever advantage that they have among their constituencies. Just to take a quick look at where we are so far in early voting, women voters comprise about 56% of the electorate. In November, it was 53%. If you're a Democrat, you probably like that number. Same with Black voters. They're outpacing, you know, where it ended up in November. But when you look at younger voters, it explains why you've seen Raphael Warnock hitting the college campuses nonstop in these last few days. They're trying to get that number up, most likely. And for Democrats, the argument is, as you were saying, Jeff, about the balance of power in the Senate. They need this extra vote because it makes the difference between them relying on, Raphael Warnock or a Joe Manchin.
Without question. I mean, and also, like I said earlier, on committee assignments, I mean, it really is a big deal. It's not paid attention all that much, but they've been split 50-50, Republicans and Democrats, on every committee. So Democrats having the majority will actually give them the full majority, but to take some of the Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema power away and also save some time for the vice president. She won't be having to go to the Hill every time there's a vote.
Shuttle back and forth down Pennsylvania Avenue for Vice President Kamala Harris. Yeah, and I mean, and Joe Manchin is also pretty happy that he may not have to be in the line of fire quite as much as he used to be. But coming up next for us, a shakeup in the Democratic Party calendar could leave the state of Iowa behind, and we will still be treated to some images like this from the all-important Iowa State Fair.
Is it cold?
It is ice cold and tasty. It's delicious. And it's going to go well with my pork chop.
Democrats are on the brink of the party's biggest primary shakeup in decades. On Friday, the DNC's Rules Committee approved President Biden's proposal to reshape its 2024 nominating calendar. If the full DNC gives the go-ahead, South Carolina would take Iowa's coveted spot as the first in the nation, followed by Nevada and New Hampshire just 3 days later. Georgia and Michigan would round out the five earliest contests. The committee vote was near unanimous, with no surprise, Iowa and New Hampshire as the only dissenters. Though their populations may be small, these two states have had a big impact on presidential election cycles for the last 50 years.
New Hampshire tonight has made Bill Clinton the comeback kid.
Yeah! Iowa, I love you.
You have done what the cynics said we couldn't do.
So as I stand here tonight, breathing a big sigh of relief, thank you, Iowa.
So Iowa and New Hampshire used to make or break candidates and their campaigns until 2020. And that's also when I think the Democratic Party had a very public conversation about whether their nominating process was actually producing nominees that appealed to their voters. And I think that this change, explicitly from the memo written by President Biden to the DNC, is about centering Black and brown communities at the beginning of the process, not the end.
Absolutely. I think at its very core, right, this is about emphasizing the base of the party, kind of reaching out to the base of the party early. As you've seen Black voters turning out for Democrats in numbers that are, you know, disproportionately large, right, in election after election. And so I think that acknowledging the diversity of the party, the diverse coalition they're trying to build, right, starting in South Carolina, then moving into Nevada with a large Latino population. I think for President Biden and the coalition that he formed in 2020 and for Democrats moving forward, that is the vision of the party that they are looking.
And I don't want to ignore the parts of this that are not just about race. It's also about ideology. It's also about socioeconomic status. You have in Michigan representation from the Midwest, from kind of working class communities in the South, South Carolina and Georgia. What you're talking about there are voters who are actually a little bit more conservative than some of the Democratic primary voters that you might find in New Hampshire and even in Iowa.
This has been decades in the making from the perspective of Michigan. Debbie Dingell will tell you that they've been lobbying for a long time because Michigan is actually really representative of the broader country. You have big minority populations in the cities like Detroit and Flint. You have more rural areas like the cherry farmers up and down the expressway 75. And you have the unions, which are a huge base of the Democratic Party. So, look, the big argument for Iowa and New Hampshire has long been that they are small states. They allow upstart candidates who may be less known, less well-funded, to get a foothold that they might not have otherwise had. But the way they've structured this, New Hampshire is not going to come much. It's, I mean, 4 days later, right? So it's really going to be also a question of how you prioritize your funding. And there's always a chance to reassess. Part of what Biden was proposing here was every 4 years potentially looking at this, because it's been since the 1970s that Iowa has had this stronghold.
Right. And I mean, the model of having Iowa and New Hampshire go first had always been about, like Heidi is saying, sort of the more retail aspect of campaigning when you're, you know, maybe not as known as a candidate. This clearly, this is a calendar and a geographic makeup that advantages someone like President Biden, who is a known quantity and has had a lot of success in these states and knows how to campaign there and can campaign in all of those places all at once. If you're an upstart candidate who's less known, that's going to be a lot more difficult, particularly when you're jamming New Hampshire and Nevada to get Nevada together. Nevada's a huge state.
Yeah.
You know, New Hampshire, obviously very small, but an expensive media market. So there are going to be a lot of factors at play here, but no question, you know, this is a way of kind of going straight to the base and of the party and various aspects of it, unions, people of color, and really trying to give them more of a voice earlier on.
Yeah,
to set the predicate.
Two things just to highlight in what you said. The time between South Carolina and Nevada and New Hampshire is 3 days.
Right.
That's not a lot of time. But Nevada is not going to go quietly into the night. Maggie Hassan, Democratic senator from New Hampshire, says, "I strongly oppose the president's deeply misguided proposal. Well, make no mistake, New Hampshire's law is clear, and our primary will continue to be the first in the nation." They're going to fight. I mean, maybe Iowa acknowledges that after what happened in the caucuses two years ago, they can't really complain. But this may not be as easy as just saying this is what we want to do.
It's not. And we're going to be talking about this for the next a couple years, because there is a state law in both Iowa and New Hampshire that says they go first. Who cares? So the DNC will have to make a decision.
Basically, that's what the DNC is saying.
For sure. The DNC will have to make a decision if they're going to strip their delegates or not. We'll get all into the weeds on that. But I think history will show that it's certainly a different time now. But going back just to looking at some of those clips of the young Senator Barack Obama there in 2007. I covered that campaign from start to finish, and it's clear that most people didn't give him much of a chance, including in South Carolina and in other states. So he put together an Iowa coalition of young people, of old people, black, white, et cetera, even though it's a small, diverse population, and he won Iowa, and that showed that he could win elsewhere. So it is a different moment now, but certainly the history, Jimmy Carter as well. So Iowa has a long history here, but we should point out Republicans still go in Iowa. So all the Republican candidates in 2024 will be heading there.
And on the organizing piece, I should point out, if anything, Georgia has showed us,
right,
organizing happens in other places. And I don't think that we can assume that it can only be demonstrated in Iowa. We've seen it in Georgia to great effect for the Democrats. But coming up next for us, Kanye West professes his love of Hitler. And in his silence, former President Trump is making it clear where he stands on the matter. Former President Trump's dinner guests are still spewing hate. And just when you thought Kanye West's anti-Semitic rhetoric couldn't get more vile, it did. Take a listen to just a small portion of what he had to say this week.
I see good things about Hitler also. This guy that invented highways, invented the very microphone that I use as a musician. You can't say out loud that this person ever did anything good. Every human being has something of value that they brought to the table, especially Hitler. There's a lot of things that I love about Hitler. A lot of things.
We play that so you can understand what's out there in the open right now. This is a man that former President Trump chose to spend time with. He is also a man whose rhetoric former President Trump refuses to condemn. The Republican Jewish Coalition issued a statement this past week saying, in part, enough is enough. But when is it enough for the former president? And when is it enough for his party? We're back with our panel here. The astonishing part of all of this though perhaps not surprising, is that Trump still hasn't condemned any of this. And there doesn't really seem to be any kind of effort to get him to.
Yeah, the difference between 2016 and today is pretty stark in that Trump has been platforming this type of extremism, but mostly with a wink and a nod. Like, he initially refused to condemn David Duke, if you recall, during 2016. But now it's actually playing QAnon music at his rallies. He's talking about exonerating the January 6th insurrectionists who've been convicted. And this is speaks very loudly, given that you have Kanye West's comments so upsetting to so many Americans. The question is whether voters now are going to reject that. It seems like a lot of people in the party are ready to be done with him. But look, this was similar in 2016 when you had the entire institution of national security experts in the Republican Party, people like Lindsey Graham, saying that they didn't support him. And so ultimately the voters have said, no, we'll make that decision.
I mean, the striking thing here is that we have seen some Republicans, some leading Republicans, particularly in Congress, come out and say this is abhorrent. These comments are abhorrent. He should not, you know, these people should not ever be a part of the Republican Party. They've pushed back on the views of Kanye West and Nick Fuentes, the other man who Trump dined with, but they haven't directly criticized the president for associating with them, and they haven't called on him publicly to disavow any of this. Not that he would, right? I mean, this is, I think a lot of Republicans see that as a losing battle, but if you are a leader in a party and you hear this kind of abhorrent rhetoric, you know, it behooves you to basically call on everyone to push back on it and to reject it. And that we just don't see that happening. And I think, you know, as you said, it's at this point, it's not surprising because they have long since learned, the leading Republicans, that calling on the former president to reject comments like this and people like this and ideology like this just doesn't work. And frankly, I think they are somewhat worried about alienating some voters who they know in their base actually either will tolerate or actually support.
Yeah,
this sort of thing.
It's probably about 35% of at least the Republican electorate that is fine with pretty much anything that Trump does. But just to add to what you're saying, the big picture here is an emergence of a candidate who seems to be running pretty explicitly on extremism. Here is a Truth Social post from yesterday from the former president where he says in part about the 2020 election, a massive fraud of this type and magnitude allows for the termination of all rules, regulations, and articles, even those found in the Constitution. You don't have to take a leap to figure out what he's talking about there. And yet, this is the guy who claims he's the leader of the Republican Party.
Yeah, you know, this is the former president is a person who has always run towards those who have been most enthusiastic about him. And what his most recent posts, what his sort of lack of a condemnation of, you know, radical extremist views say is that, you know, he views those people as the sort of base, as those who are most enthusiastic about him. But it is also a fundamental subversion of, you know, democracy, right? Sort of moving past the Constitution is a subversion of democracy. And so, you know, I think that as we move towards 2024, that has to be in the back of your mind that one of the leading candidates, probably the front runner for the Republican Party, the former president, is actively moving towards more radical, more extreme views. And that is funneling down to members of his party below.
And Heidi, you mentioned the January 6th insurrectionists. This also is something that's becoming at the heart of the former president's reelection campaign. Listen to what he said at a fundraiser for the families of January 6th insurrectionists, by the way, just this past week.
Patriot freedom is what it's about. And that's not happening in our country. What they've done to torment people and go after people like never before, we're going to be, as you know, looking about it and talking about it very, very strongly in the coming weeks, months, and over the next period of a year, year and a half during the campaign.
It tells you a lot about where this is all headed.
It absolutely does. And it's like as though the midterm elections didn't happen, as though there was no lesson at all for the former president or for Republicans. It gives Republicans, I talk to donors, elected officials, so much angst and pause that that this is at the forefront, because this is not where the conversation should be for a winning message for the party. But to go back to the base, like you said, the 35%, that's all the former president likely needs to win a primary, because certainly if there's a broad field. So, look, he's going to keep saying things like this. I think the question is, are they going to be diminished in terms of how much oxygen they consume? Is he going to consume all the oxygen in the race, or is he going to be diminished bit by all these various controversies? It feels different to me than 2015 and 2016, but we'll see.
Yeah, I mean, I think that everyone has been given pause, but no one is really organizing a sort of effort to marginalize Trump, but not just Trump. The interesting thing is that this is happening in a broader context in which conservatives are kind of grappling with these figures in their midst. And, you know, Kanye West was back on Twitter in part because Elon Musk let him back on. And, you know, now Elon Musk is a hero to the right. Rick Scott writes a letter to Elon Musk thanking him for then suspending Kanye for being an anti-Semite on Twitter. I want to express my thanks for the swift action of the suspension of the Twitter account of Ye following the sickening comments praising Nazis and Adolf Hitler. The same week, the Daily Stormer is back on Twitter. It just seems to me there is a lot of kind of playing around with these forces in the Republican Party, and they've got to decide who's in the camp and who's not.
Look, it's not just playing around. It's unleashed. I think it was the New York Times that had a story this week that showed that since Elon Musk took over Twitter, anti-Semitic posts have gone up 60%. So there is, unfortunately, a market for this. And to Jeff's point, if there's a big split field and a lot of Republicans running, 35% is a huge number. I'm not saying that 35% is anti-Semitic or that this specific message of anti-Semitism appeals to 35%, but they're willing to go along with it. They've showed in the past they're willing to go along with it. If they're strong Trump supporters, look past it. Whereas there is a portion that it directly appeals to, and that's the truth, unfortunately.
Yeah, it is the unfortunate truth. And I mean, it just strikes me that the condemnation has not been strong enough because it's not going away. In fact, these people are very much emboldened. But coming up next for us, what does the new House Democratic leader really think of Kevin McCarthy? We've got brand new CNN reporting on that coming up next. We have new reporting this morning. In his first major interview since being elected as Democratic leader, Congressman Hakeem Jeffries is telling CNN how he plans to win back the majority. Part of that strategy, unifying the Democratic Party ranks, an advantage that he touted earlier this week.
Sometimes we can have noisy conversations, but as we showed time and time again on issue after issue after issue, at the end of the day, we always come together, find the highest common denominator, and get big things done for everyday Americans.
The CNN's Isaac DeVere, who landed that interview, joins our panel now. So, Isaac, Hakeem Jeffries is known to be pretty disciplined kind of political figure, which is why he landed at the top of the pack without really much ado about it. So tell us what you learned about how this kind of younger, new generation of the Democratic Party plans to lead.
Well, look, I first met Hakeem Jeffries when he was running for assembly in 2006. He has always been a very careful guy, carefully working his way up here. That's how you have this major change in Democratic leadership that ended with not even an opponent for him or his two deputies. These three people who, with Catherine Clark and Pete Aguilar, the leaders of the Democrats in the House now, who none of them were even in Congress when Barack Obama was elected in 2008. They're replacing people who are all in their 80s. And they are looking to figure out how to get this very rapidly changing Democratic Party and Democratic caucus to be on the same page with a singular goal in mind, which is to defy history again and make a Republican majority here just 2-year majority. They think that they can keep progressives in check and not have them being causing all sorts of trouble for where the agenda would want to go. That's easier, of course, in the minority when they don't have to think about making deals that'll actually work their way into law. But it's also about really hitting Republicans a lot on extremism. I asked Jeffries do you respect Kevin McCarthy? And he said to me, well, Kevin McCarthy and I serve in Congress together.
Well, let's read this section. You asked him what he thinks of McCarthy. He said, we serve in Congress together and stop talking. Asked if he respects McCarthy, Jeffries said, I respect the fact that he's the current House Republican leader. And depending on what happens on January 3rd, maybe the next Republican speaker, not exactly the most effusive.
No.
But you know, perhaps he could have taken a few more jabs and held back.
Sure. And Mitch McConnell, the Senate Republican leader, after Jeffries was elected, went to the floor of the Senate and started hitting on Jeffries and saying he called Trump a fake president. He's attacked the judiciary. I asked Jeffries about that, and he said to me, you know, it seems like most of America rejected Donald Trump, but if Mitch McConnell wants to stay with Trump, then okay, that's the decision. But he said going on the attack and not talking about what they want to actually get done for Americans, going right back onto message there, is in line with the Republicans. I think you're going to see that be what they do a lot.
And you made a good point about his relationship with progressives, which is going to be the big test. He has 2 years to sort it out in the minority. But here's just a little bit of a taste of what that relationship has been like between Jeffries and the squad. These are actually the quotes. Jeffries said there's nothing more unifying than being in the minority and having a clear objective getting back into the majority. And AOC told Axios, asked if Jeffries is someone she can work with. She says, I think that's something we'll learn. Cori Bush also told Axios, I appreciate being approached. He acknowledged that, you know, you're part of the caucus, too. So they're giving him a little bit of the benefit of the doubt for the moment.
I think they definitely are. And the reality is this is going to be easier being in the minority. He's not going to be the speaker. And the whole plan is to try and get Democrats to win back the House. So they want the next 2 years to be about the Republican majority. They don't want it to be about the Democratic minority. We'll see if he can hold it together. But as you said, he was elected very swiftly here without much opposition. So I think that gives you a sense of his support and respect among his colleagues.
Let's talk about the other side of the aisle, though. On the Republican side, it's definitely not going to be that easy for Kevin McCarthy. He is still trying to wrangle the votes to get to 218. And he seems confident, but his opponents are also equally confident that he won't get there.
If you don't think you'll have 218 when it finally comes to floor, would you step down in the race for Speaker?
No. We'll have 218.
And what else? You can't get there.
I'll get there.
He's not going to be Speaker. He doesn't have the votes to get to 218. He's not going to get to 218. I hope that Kevin McCarthy will say and recognize, okay, for the good of the country, for the good of the party, for the good of Congress, I'm going to pull myself out.
It's not going to be easy, and a lot of Republicans at this moment think they're going to have multiple ballots on this.
Absolutely. I mean, look, it's just a math problem that they have, and it's made worse by the fact that the majority is going to be so small for the Republicans. So he really can only afford to lose a handful of Republicans. Obviously, all the Democrats are going to vote against him on the floor. He needs 218. And right now there are five people and more privately are saying they say that group is actually much larger. He lost more than 30 people, 36 people, I believe it was, when he was nominated for Speaker by secret ballot a couple of weeks ago. So he clearly doesn't have the votes right now. And I think he would acknowledge that. What he's saying is he's not going to step aside willingly. But the question is he going to be forced to step aside? And the problem that he has, if you look back, I mean, Nancy Pelosi did face a similar issue 4 years ago. She had about three dozen people in her caucus who had not voted for her to nominate her for Speaker. But if you look at what she was doing at this time 4 years ago, she was methodically meeting with people, cutting deals with them, and getting them over to her side. There were more than a dozen members, Democrats, who she figured out a way to get on her side. Kevin McCarthy is dealing with people who, almost by definition, don't want anything except for his head.
Yeah, except
right?
for and,
they
and,
just and, don't want him to be
and
Speaker.
For some degree of chaos. I mean, it's going to be a chaotic
right.
few weeks.
So how do you win people right. like that over? And you heard Bob Good and others say they can't be won over.
Right, exactly. I mean, he's willing to give them whatever perhaps they want, but they may not want anything except his head. Coming up next, DeSantis is being touted as the 2024 frontrunner, and he's receiving the scrutiny that comes along with all of that. So is he ready for primetime? That's next. The frontrunner treatment, that is what Florida Governor Ron DeSantis has been receiving this week, despite the fact that he hasn't made it clear he's even running for president. At least three different publications have taken a deeper look into the newly reelected governor, and some of the coverage was, shall we say, less than flattering. Mark Leibovich in The Atlantic writes, quote, people who know him better and have watched him longer are skeptical of his ability to take on the former president. He can be awkward and plodding, and he is not a fun and convivial dude. He prefers to keep his earbuds in. His step away from the vehicle vibes are strong. Ron DeSantis is quite, the favorite of the political class in Washington, the donor class, so on and so forth. But Heidi, the voters will decide, and we really don't know whether this is going to translate on a national stage.
Right now, these profiles also coincide with some polling from reputable Republican firms that show that DeSantis is doing a good job in this very early stage of kind of coalescing the Trumpy side of the party along with the more traditional Reagan Republican side of the party. But we all know, and we all lived through 2016, when we saw that Trump does a great job at branding, mostly branding his opponents. And so once DeSantis becomes more of a known quantity, really that's up in the air. Right now, a lot of these polls also show that people, you know, a lot of people don't even know who he is or what he's about. And so, yeah, once he gets more onto the stage and Trump has a bite at him, it could really change.
Yeah, I mean, some of the polling, in addition to what you just mentioned, also seems to indicate that compared to Trump, he might do better than Trump at competing against Biden. Here's this Marquette poll that shows Biden would lead Trump by 10 points if the election were held today. Biden versus DeSantis, that's an even race. So that's what makes DeSantis feel pretty good about his chances, right, perhaps. But again, to Heidi's point, very few people know him. And at the end of the day, once you get out of the bubble and it's not just theoretical and you're interacting with real people, that starts to affect the game.
Without a doubt. But look, he comes into this very strong in the sense that he had a very strong reelection. I mean, an incredible reelection in Florida. And look, he has coalesced a lot of donors, but we have no idea who the Republican nominee will be or the frontrunners are going to be. But he starts out in an enviable position, but so did Scott Walker, the Wisconsin governor back in 2014. So you don't want to win the primary of 2023. You obviously want to win the primary of 2024, but I still think you'd rather be him than some of these other Republicans. But the question is, Fox News has taken quite a liking to him. He's on constantly. So do you have to run the same kind of campaign, shaking hands and being in living rooms as you used to? But Donald Trump sort of showed us you didn't necessarily. You had rallies and things. So we'll see, but it's far too early for us to say that he's going to be the nominee, but he's in a decent spot.
Yeah, well, speaking of Scott Walker, there's Scott Walker leads a tight GOP pack in the new Iowa poll. This was January 2015, and Jeb Bush surges to 2016 GOP frontrunner in December 2014.
Right.
So, yeah,
there are risks to peaking too early, right? There are risks to being seen as, you know, sort of the antidote to whatever ails the party going into the primary season. And as much as it's important, and obviously Republicans love to see those poll numbers that show him neck and neck with Biden in a hypothetical race, the first and much bigger challenge for any candidate, certainly any Republican candidate in this day and age, is the primary. And we know that Trump will be a presence. We know that he has mastered that process of winning a Republican primary. And of course, it will be very different this time around, given the mix of candidates and given how much of a head of steam DeSantis seems to have. But that is going to be a huge obstacle for him to get over. And we really don't know how he's going to do when voters start to take a much closer look at him, those Republican primary voters who are so important to get him over that hump, to even get to the point where he's maybe facing President Biden.
That's exactly right. I mean, I think maybe Trump didn't do all the hand-holding, but he had a hold on people.
For sure.
He related to them in a certain way. But that's it for us on Inside Politics Sunday. Up next on CNN, State of the Union with Jake Tapper and Dana Bash. And Jake's guests this morning include Secretary of State Antony Blinken and Senator Sherrod Brown. And just be sure to tune in this this Tuesday evening for our election night coverage of Georgia's Senate race. Our coverage starts on Tuesday afternoon at 4 p.m., I will be there all night. Hope you will be too. And thank you again for sharing your Sunday morning with us. Have a beautiful rest of your day.
Now streaming exclusively on Max, a new CNN flash doc about the album that has Nashville talking, Call Me Country, Beyonce and Nashville's Renaissance. Watch it at max.com/callmecountry. Max subscription required.